Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The 2016 campaign season has been a doozy. Lies, taunts, low blows, body parts. It's hard to imagine. It's what the founding fathers hoped for. But my guest today says the founding era, the Revolutionary War before and after, was a bonfire of wild political fireworks, hard-edged, raucous, rugged, often rougher than ours right now. This hour On Point, free speech and the fiery birth of politics and dissent in America. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do we learn from a then and now comparison here? Did you think it was all curtsies and minuets back then at the beginning? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from New York is Stephen Solomon, professor of journalism at New York University, where he specializes in the First Amendment, freedom of speech, the press. His new book is Revolutionary Dissent: How the Founding Generation Created the Freedom of Speech. You can find an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Stephen Solomon, Steve, thank you very much for being with us today.
Tom, thank you for having me.
So does this year even really pale in comparison to revolutionary era political back and forth?
Well, the words nasty, vitriolic, scathing, those are strong words, and they all applied back then, probably even more so than now. But interestingly enough, it didn't start that way, because back in the 1600s, the earliest days of the colonies, there was this crime called seditious libel, which was inherited through the common law of England. And it made it illegal to criticize the government or government officials. And in the 1600s and early 1700s, there were about 1,200 prosecutions of people for criticizing officials over very small matters. But the consequences were severe. Jailings, fines, people were tied up and lashed, even ears were cut off.
For what exactly? What kind of speech in that period was out of bounds?
Oh, I mean, even, you know, a tax collector would come to your home and ask for the taxes, and you would say some nasty words at him, and they would arrest you.
No wonder they wanted freedom of speech right there in the Constitution.
They put up with the penalties then. So the question is, how did we move from the strong suppression of speech at that time, to now, where you have presidential candidates and just about anybody who has a Twitter account, that they, you know, now they can put out nasty, scornful, disrespectful material. So how did we get from then to now? And the answer is that before Americans could fight a war against the British, they first had to fight against the strictures that criminalized dissent against the government. And that started to happen in the 1760s, when Parliament unwisely passed the Stamp Act, and you got into all kinds of questions of taxation without representation that we're all familiar with. The Stamp Act put a heavy tax on paper documents, including newspapers, which was a strategic error because it got all the newspaper publishers, and there were about 20 or 30 of them at the time, very angry at the British. And the colonists thought that their rights were being violated. And the dissent started with pamphlets and with the newspapers, because they said that the newspapers were fighting for their survival against this tax. And, you know, the initial arguments were with pamphlets and newspapers. You know, people talked about the rights of Englishmen under Magna Carta and so forth. And but the elite in America realized that in order to win this battle against Parliament, they had to really democratize protest. It couldn't just stay with the upper classes of politicians and merchants who would understand the constitutional arguments. And so they popularized protest. They used every means at their disposal to protest, and they were enormously inventive. So beyond the newspapers and pamphlets, they used broadsides and letters.
What's a broadside, Steve?
So a broadside was a quick printing of typically one page that you would do in a couple hours or a day.
And just really lay into somebody in that broadside.
Yeah, you lay into someone. And the ministers were very active in the Patriot cause, preaching thunderous sermons, and people went out of doors and engaged in big demonstrations, and they had liberty trees, liberty poles. They strung up effigies of the British officials that they hated. And so as the protests spread and became popularized, it became nasty and scornful. And at the same time, the British royal governors were not sitting around. They wanted to stop the protests. They were upset themselves. And so they started bringing these seditious libel prosecutions that worked successfully in the 1600s, but they didn't work anymore.
Because juries just wouldn't do it after a while.
Exactly.
They would not convict after a while.
Exactly. They would not convict their neighbors for doing something that they themselves were doing, which was criticizing in the nastiest of terms what the British were doing. So what the colonists were doing with the protests were rejecting the restrictions on speech, and they were forming a new and vibrant political culture. And that continued through the founding period. It continued into the early days of the Republic with Washington and Adams and Jefferson. And then right to the present day.
But give us a sense of that, Steve, because we think back and, you know, we think about the Declaration of Independence and the beautiful rhetoric there, the Constitution with its clarity, the Federalist Papers with their reasoning. It seems like anything but scurrilous sort of verbal fisticuffs.
Yeah, well, we think of the Founding Fathers as intellectual giants, and in many ways they were, but in other instances they often took on pseudonyms. In fact, Samuel Adams had about 25 pseudonyms so that he could write all kinds of nasty things. And people suspected it was him, but they couldn't prove it. Abigail Adams had a very long view of all this. She had the experience of the 1760s with the Stamp Act protests all the way through her husband's administration. And she said that there was enough venom expressed during the founding period, and I'm quoting her here, to ruin and corrupt the minds and morals of the best people in the world. Wow. And I guess we could say that about debate today. Ruins and corrupts the minds and morals of the best people in the world.
But it's not like we made it up worse. In 2016. You've got a little example from the Boston Gazette back in that Stamp Act period where they're going after they wanted the American colonists to colonials to pay a tax on printed on paper. And the Boston Gazette just went off on this. Can you give us a little reading of that?
Sure. Well, the Boston Gazette was a radical paper, probably the most radical in a colonies and possibly in American history. So that they kind of set a standard. So they published all kinds of vitriolic material. So here's one. Let therefore all those apostate sons of venality, those wretched hirelings and parasites, those firstborn sons of hell, who for a little filthy lucre have thus far, as they were able, betrayed and murdered their country with a vile slander of their contagious breath and dire hissing of their forked tongues, conscious of their base perfidious lies, let them blush and be confounded at the light of the sun and tremble at the countenance of the sons of honor and virtue.
You've got to do a little translation for us here. Back in the day, did base perfidious lies and wretched hirelings sound like fighting words? I mean, they are, but they sound kind of high-blown at the same time to our ears today, perhaps.
Well, they were fighting words back then, and they could, in another time, an earlier time, they would have landed people in jail. So that was, those were fighting words, especially since they were, aiming it at a lot of officials.
And sooner or later, that came into the whole definition of free speech. I mean, Americans really stood up for that in opposition to this seditious libel threat that had been held over their heads for decades and decades and decades.
Well, in the founding period, they were so vociferous, they really formed a political culture that we have today. And I think they defined through what they did in the streets and in their writings what they meant by freedom of expression. They meant a really wide open, uninhibited, robust speech. And that's what they engaged in. They wrote and ratified the First Amendment. And, one can argue that they meant the First Amendment to mean that it protected the kind of speech that they had engaged in.
And you've got another reading there. What was this about the Liberty, the Sons of Liberty burning effigies? It wasn't just It wasn't just a hot language. They also got out in the streets and really went after it. Do you want to give us a sense of that?
Okay. So they constructed effigies and did a lot of ceremonial things. The Sons constructed a stage with effigies of the Earl of Bute and George Grenville. He was the prime minister. Above them on a gallows, the devil himself appeared, holding a copy of the Stamp Act and a stamped piece of paper. With the people roaring three cheers, the Sons cut down the effigies, placed them in a cart, and began a parade through the town. They returned to the Liberty Tree for another three cheers, then walked south to the town gallows on the Boston Neck to carry out the judge's sentence. The Sons built a huge bonfire and threw in the effigies in a stamped paper, which they called the Badge of Slavery.
Boston, blazing there again, of course, a very prominent early city in the colonies. We've got a lot more to look at here, but when you just sit back and look at the quality of our political exchange today to the quality and ferocity then, what do you say?
Well, I think the ferocity was every bit as, shall I say, impressive back then. One big difference, though, was that back in colonial times, the period that we're talking about, a lot of the vitriol was done by surrogates of politicians. So they would enlist the newspapers to write on their behalf. Also, a lot of the vitriol was done with pseudonyms, as I mentioned before.
Now you've got people today, right on the stage.
Yeah. So, but today, I mean, someone like Donald Trump and others feel very comfortable with themselves right out in the open, saying all kinds of things that a lot of people find upsetting.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the American tradition of fiery, outrageous political speech all the way back to the Revolutionary War years and before, and how it is still playing out in our politics today. My guest is Stephen Solomon. He's author of the new book, Revolutionary Dissent, How the Founding Generation Created the Freedom of Speech. You can read an excerpt of that at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can join us this hour. Can you picture full-on firestorms when it was all essays and pamphlets, coffee houses and proclamations? And what about the rough stuff? Men burned, hung in effigies, riot and uprising. Is it comforting to know how rough it was that we survived that? Does all make you feel a little better about 2016, or does it still feel like we're in some new, maybe dangerous territory now? Steve Solomon joins me from New York. Take us deeper into the kind of exchanges people had and how they compare to today, Steve.
Well, if you look at, for example, the early days of the Republic with the Washington administration and Adams and Jefferson, they really went at each other. I mean, that was probably the most vitriolic period, which might be surprising. I mean, Washington, for example, was basically, in the two elections, he was elected by acclamation, and very quickly things broke down. The country, actually his cabinet, divided along the lines of Jefferson starting the Republican Party and Hamilton the Federalists. And big questions were being decided then, because the Constitution had just been ratified and a lot of things were up for grabs. And Hamilton and Jefferson really went at it. At one point, Jefferson wrote to his friend Madison and said, in a letter referring to Hamilton, he said to Madison, "Pick up your pen and cut Hamilton to pieces." And Madison did. And Jefferson and Madison recruited Madison's old friend, Philip Furneaux, Madison's classmate at the College of New Jersey, and helped them start a newspaper to attack Washington. And those kinds of things happened. I mean, the politicians sometimes subsidized journalists to write screeds against their opponents. And, Benjamin Franklin Bache, the grandson of Benjamin Franklin, had a newspaper in Philadelphia called the Aurora, and he said of Washington, that he had been a spy for the British while he was a commander of the Continental Army. So, I mean, all these things were, you know, just outrageous. A lot of them lies. A lot of them, you know, just scandal-mongery. And it just went on and on.
You've got people who we think of as sort of revolutionary icons who were part of this sharp edge discourse of that time. Paul Revere, right out front, and in his sort of cartooning capacity, Steve.
Well, Paul Revere, you know, very well known for the Midnight Ride, but his more significant contribution was how he defined what became known as the Boston Massacre. So the Boston, Boston was occupied by British troops for a couple years. There was a lot of animosity between citizens and the troops. And on March 5th, 1770, a crowd gathered and started pelting British sentries with ice and snowballs and pieces of coal. One thing led to another. Some shots broke out, and you know, some Bostonians were killed. The British said that this was an unfortunate incident, and but very quickly, the Boston Gazette came out and called it a horrid massacre. But it was up to Paul Revere to really define the meaning of the event, and so. He made an engraving, and the engraving shows British troops, about seven or eight of them, lined up execution style with their rifles pointing at the crowd. Their commander, Captain Preston, is standing in back of him with his sword uplifted, like he's commanding them to fire. And it looks like a massacre. The only problem was that that was all false. But Paul Revere kind of owned the narrative, and that became iconic even in its time, spread up and down the colonies, up and down the coast. And people were enraged when they saw innocent civilians lying on the ground, blood pouring out of holes in their bodies, and the British soldiers, you know, with their muskets still pointed at them. So he wrote the narrative of an event which was completely false.
Steve Solomon's new book is Revolutionary Descent. Call it for you, Steve. Angelique in Lake Orion, Michigan. Angelique, you're on the air with Steve Solomon.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited about the topic today. And I find it great that you brought up Paul Revere, because there's a lot of dialogue in higher academia comparing Paul Revere to someone else who also rode through the streets, but he was really, and what made him different, in controlling the dialogue. So I find the subject fascinating. I think a lot of people that find American history fascinating have felt quieted for years. And you asked, Tom, what would the Founding Fathers possibly have thought about what's going on in politics today? And
yes.
I think that they would be entirely fired up about what a lot of people are calling the polarization and the height and level of participation, where you have people going very, very far to the left, very, very far to the right, and this increase in dialogue, as nasty as it has gotten. But for people like myself that know and love American history, this is an exciting time and perhaps a time to really get something accomplished because of the openness and the frankness of the dialogue. So I do also think that the Founding Fathers might also be disappointed by the things that they risked their necks for, the freedoms, and including freedom of speech, that they risked their neck for, that we've kind of forgotten. We've had recently a lot of money and attention and education on STEM, but I think it's unfortunate that not a lot of these things, such as rugged individualism or civil disobedience, these are things that, concepts that you would be able to teach 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds, but our public education kind of, you know, sets these to the side and focus on other things. And unfortunately, we're only a country with 300 years of history.
Yeah.
We're not Russia with thousands, or China with dynasties and thousands of years. And people from other nations study us as the first country whose people is supposed to dictate what its government does.
Angelique, let me jump in right there and pick up on your sort of posing that perhaps the founders would come and listen to our political dialogue today and see a kind of a valuable yeastiness in it, Steve, even though it's nasty sometimes, bracing in a way that's maybe moving toward change. Do you think so, Steve?
I think basically, yes. But I think they would be very surprised by the fact that some of the candidates themselves are engaging in such speech. As I said before, a lot of the worst of the speech in the past was conducted like through surrogates, often by pseudonyms. And, you know, to have candidates, you know, denigrate women and denigrate Muslims and so forth. I think they would recognize that as protected speech, but I think they might be a little disappointed that candidates for office were voicing that. On the other hand, you know, one of the values of speech is to know exactly what's in the heart of the candidates who are putting themselves forward for election, and it's important to know that if someone has harbors certain feelings about groups of people or other issues that they talk frankly about it, and we know where they stand. It may be offensive, it may be a little hard to hear, but at least we know when we go to the voting booth where exactly they stand on it.
Or at least how they think, whether it goes to deep principle, I don't know. Here's a little bit, we'll hear some sound from right now in this hour. Here's Donald Trump in December at a rally in Michigan talking about Hillary Clinton's bathroom break during a Democratic debate.
I know where she went. It's disgusting. I don't want to talk about it. No, it's too disgusting. Don't say it. It's disgusting. Let's not talk. We want to be very, very straight up, okay?
Steve Solomon, I can't quite hear that in the mouth of George Washington.
Well, certainly not George Washington. He was very proper, but you can imagine that in the mouth of some others. There was a verse published during the revolutionary period that accused Britain of giving venereal disease to the colonies. They were portrayed as a mother giving her children pox, slavery, and itch. In another instance, James Callender, who was probably one of the worst scandalmongers among the journalists, revealed that Hamilton, you know, while he was Treasury Secretary, was having an affair with a married woman and was paying hush money to her husband. And, you know, Jefferson, who was an enemy of Hamilton, certainly enjoyed that revelation until it hit him, because Callender, who was supported for a time financially by Jefferson, later turned against him and wrote that Jefferson was having an affair with a slave named Sally Hemings. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can get stung by this kind of thing that you might be sponsoring in secret.
Donald Trump, here he was last June, famously on Mexican immigrants coming to the U.S. with problems.
They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people. But I speak to border guards, and they tell us what we're getting.
I mean, that often seen as kind of a blanket. Yes, he says some good people, but a kind of blanket smear on people there.
Sure. Sure. And there are precedents for that. I mean, back in colonial times, there was a celebration on November 5th of each year called Pope Day. There's a lot of hatred of Catholics because it was a lot of these colonies were Protestant. And every November 5th, they would parade with effigies of the Pope and the devil and go around town and then throw the effigies into a bonfire. And then during the Adams administration, they vilified the French because the United States was very close to a war with France. And as Congress passed the Alien Act, which gave the president the power to imprison or deport French people. You know, does that sound familiar in some ways?
Yeah.
There was scathing speech against the French. Hamilton said that the French in America would be traitors and they would rise up against America if there was a war.
Does that justify what was said then, justify what we've heard on the campaign trail now?
No. I mean, that's just hatred. That's, appealing to the very basis of instincts. But it's out there. I mean, it's protected speech. If the actions that themselves that are being recommended are not themselves legal. I don't think you can stop Muslims at the border. I think that would be a constitutional problem, among other things.
Let's go to Granby, Colorado, and Lance. Lance, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. Thanks for this program. I'm currently listening to The Great Divide, a book on the relationship with Thomas Jefferson, George Washington. And Tom, I loved your comment about what would the founding fathers say or feel about what's happening today. And appreciate the comment that, so much of the rhetoric right now that's happening does appeal to the basest instincts and the ignorance. I think the founding fathers would be dismayed to see the hatred and the ignorance that's being proposed and catching fire here. I mean, Trump's rhetoric is wildly popular among a significant portion of Americans, and it's in direct violation of the American values that those founding fathers fought and died for. And, excuse me, sorry, just that. I'll stop there.
We've got it, Lance. Steve, speak to that. I mean, here, yes, you've got a very voluble candidate on the trail. Not the only one, but sort of redefining the edge in American presidential politics. And Lance in Colorado is worried, saying, well, you've got a lot of Americans rising to respond to that. But Lance, anyway, sees it as in opposition to fundamental American values.
Well, I think it is in opposition to fundamental values. The advantage of the speech going forward is that it raises a firestorm in opposition to it. And so you have a great time arguing about this, and you don't make any assumptions about things. Everything becomes up for discussion, and if something is proposed that is prejudicial, you know, people talk about it and they understand better why it is prejudicial. And we don't forget about that. So there is a value in bringing these kind of naughty topics, these verboten topics up. They upset us, but they also inspire us to protect our liberties and those of people, no matter what their religion, no matter what their color or sex or whatever. It just inspires debate. And I think we move forward with hopefully a new dedication to protect the liberties of everyone, including freedom of speech.
That's the ideal anyway, though you got some people wondering if it could go off the rails at some point. Nadia in Miami. Nadia, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I just wanted to point out that although vitriolic political discourse has always been part of our history, the stakes are a lot higher today than they were when we were founded. After World War II, the U.S. took its position, either self-imposed or whatnot, as the leader of the free world. So every nation looks to us. We've been involved in every war since World War II. And when we behave a certain way, when our political system behaves a certain way, when our American voters lose their politiquette, as it were, and their ability to have discourse that is normal, that is progressive, that is productive, and we see that reflected in the candidates today, then that's a huge red flag to the rest of the world, especially in a globalized market where if things go wrong here, they pretty much go wrong everywhere else. So although it's always been or it's part of our history, I think it's very important to keep in mind that we can no longer afford that.
Nadia, let us pick it up right there. We're almost up on a break here. I wonder how you look at that, Steve, as someone who teaches about the First Amendment and the history of all this. Things are different now. We need to be more buttoned up.
No. I mean, that's been the approach any time the country is in crisis. All the wars that the country has fought, with the exception of the most recent one, there's always been a crisis and there's been a clamping down on speech. You know, if you can't the First Amendment tells us that you can't suppress speech on the basis of what somebody says unless they are inciting violence or unless they are threatening someone and a certain other exceptions. But, you know, who's going to make the decision that someone can't say something that is controversial? Is it the government? Well, I wouldn't want somebody in Washington telling me what I can say and not say, perhaps because it's offensive to somebody.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the American tradition of fiery, outraged, outrageous political speech all the way back to the Revolutionary War years and before, and how some of that is still playing out in our politics today. My guest, Stephen Solomon, is author of the new book, Revolutionary Dissent, How the Founding Generation Created the Freedom of Speech. You can join us this hour. What's the wildest story of political trash talk clash you've seen, read, heard? How's this year look in light of the past, 2016? And does free speech always cleanse? Could it embody, encourage bigotry, hate, division? We've seen all kinds and heard all kinds of language this year. This was John Boehner at Stanford University, April 27th. And Professor David Kennedy asked him what he thought of Ted Cruz. The audio, a little rough, courtesy of the Stanford Daily.
So how about saying your opinions on some of the other people running for the highest office? How about Ted Cruz? Lucifer in the flesh.
Lucifer in the flesh, and suddenly it feels almost like we're back in the 18th century there. May 3rd, Donald Trump associated Ted Cruz's father with Lee Harvey Oswald, the killer of John F. Kennedy, a story he picked up from the National Enquirer. Cruz responded that same day from Evansville, Indiana.
Yes, my dad killed JFK. He is secretly Elvis, and Jimmy Hoffa is buried in his backyard.
Yeah, we're right out there. And this week, John Stewart at the University of Chicago talking about Donald Trump.
He is a man baby. He's has the physical countenance of a man and a baby's temperament and hands. So,
man baby, Steve Solomon, Lucifer in the flesh, that's sort of over the top, but yes, he's Elvis. Echoes in the past?
Well, certainly. The references to Lucifer, the devil, come right from the 18th century. And keep in mind, when references were made back then, it was much more shocking because you know, most of the colonies were, you know, had established churches, and the people were quite a bit religious. There were effigies regularly strung from trees with the British Prime Minister and the devil right next to each other, and this had a tremendous impact. There was a shocking representation. You know, it was the devil was a representation of all evil in Puritan theology. So you really couldn't say anything worse. What Boehner said is strong language. People laughed. I don't think they laughed in the 18th century when they saw that. It really sent quite a profound message about who they thought the British Prime Minister was in passing these taxes. You couldn't say anything stronger.
Is there a difference between this kind of hot language, as you say, often in the mouths of surrogates, and something like demagoguery? When you read back through history, do you see demagoguery trailed through American history? Do you see something different this year?
Oh, sure. I mean, some of it involves demagoguery. I mean, you can see this all through American history, and not just the founding period. I think in the hands of great speakers, they can do that. I mean, even Patrick Henry. I think often got involved with demagoguery, even on the floor of the ratifying convention in Virginia in 1788 when they were arguing over the Constitution. He didn't know a whole lot about the Constitution and what had been drafted, but he was a great speaker, and he was able to raise all these fears about what would happen to the Southern agrarian economy and what would happen to states' rights and things like that. Very little of it had actual, it could actually be tied to what the people had written in Philadelphia. But he tried in some cases to expand the fears. And to that extent, I guess you could say he was at least partially a demagogue.
Lauren in Memphis, Tennessee. Lauren, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. My question is sort of about audience. We have this idea of who's going to Trump rallies or who might be supporting Bernie Sanders, but I'm really curious to know what this kind of rhetoric in the 18th century was targeted at. Who were they trying to influence, and who ended up influenced? It's sort of what I'd be interested to know.
Who was the audience, and how did they reach them? Steve?
Well, the audience was, in the main, it was other colonists. They were trying to make the case against British taxes and about the power of Parliament. And so the rhetoric got very intense, trying to persuade people. And, you know, the hanging of effigies and so forth, and a lot of the rhetoric was intended to popularize protest. So the audience was other colonists to increase support. And the audience was also people in England, and specifically Parliament, to the extent that the colonists thought that their protests could, you know, influence what Parliament did. And Parliament did, you know, very quickly rescind the stamp tax. They did replace it with other taxes, but the protests were completely successful. Everything that they did was with all this harsh speech was totally effective. And I think they learned from that they could, through their protests, through their uninhibited, robust, wide open speech, actually influence a legislative body sitting thousands of miles away.
Songs, essays, letters, cartoons, broadsides, woodcuts, petitions, resolutions, puns, poem, plays, paintings, pamphlets. I mean, they didn't have Twitter, but they had a lot of ways of getting out.
Oh, they were so creative. You know, they used every means at their disposal, and some of them, you know, very creative. I mean, you mentioned songs and plays and the paintings and things like that. So they were very inventive, and they used all those. I mean, the problem is that it was very difficult to circulate these things. Unlike today, we mm-hmm. take for granted that, you know, we can, you know, something we post or tweet can go around the world in seconds. Something that happened in Boston, like the Boston Massacre, I mean, it took weeks for that information to filter down south to places like Savannah and Virginia. So they were printed first in newspapers, and then the newspapers were carried by riders who would drop them off in other cities, and those articles would be reprinted. So you can follow the publications down the coast as they're reprinted. So it kind of took forever for this information to spread, and that was so as creative as they were, they really couldn't overcome the limitations that the fact that technology simply wasn't there for them. But you know, they didn't know any different. It's not like they had Twitter and then suddenly right. lost it. So they did the best with what they had, and of course the British operated under pretty much the same conditions.
And of course, things landed with the punch when they landed, the parody and satire and diatribes and harangues. Andrew in Miami, Florida, you're on the air with Steve Sullivan. Thank you for calling, Andrew.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling as a, like Mr. Sullivan, a big fan of the First Amendment, but he does seem to forget that only 10 years into our country in 1798, the Alien and Sedition Act was passed by President Adams and by Congress, which severely curtailed free speech, any form of dissent or criticism of the government, where hundreds of people were jailed and newspapers across the country were shut down. It was set to expire in 1801, calculated by Adams to occur after he was reelected, and the reelection didn't actually occur as he anticipated, primarily because of the backlash due to the Alien Sedition Act, and wanted to see what Mr. Solomon had to say about that.
Steve, how's it square with his vision of the wide open, you know, political wrangling of the time?
Well, it totally contradicts the wide open, commitment to wide open debate. And I mentioned before, you know, all the fear mongering about the French as the United States and France moved closer to war during the Adams administration, and you know, the Sedition Act was clearly aimed at the political opposition of Adams. But it didn't really squelch speech. I mean, there were probably a dozen or 15 people put in jail, and that was unfortunate. Jefferson released them from jail when he became president. But I said it didn't stop speech. And in fact, the Republican papers actually doubled in number during the three years that the Sedition Act was in effect. I mean, people just, again, they ignored the law, and the oppression was so contradictory to what they understood to be their rights that they founded more newspapers, and the Republican newspapers that were already in existence, their circulations increased. And, Sedition Act was regarded by historians as one of the reasons why the Federalists lost the election of 1800. They just overreached and paid the price for it.
Try and clamp down doesn't necessarily work. Amy in Malden, Massachusetts. Amy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. The point that I would like to make, thinking about our founding fathers, free speech is a wonderful thing, but just because we can doesn't mean that we should. I think there's a lot of hate mongering going on right now. I'm truly disgusted with the way that our politicians are behaving, and I think that many of our founding fathers would feel that way as well. I think that we should be showering each other with kindness and respect and an attitude of moving forward together and not with all this sort of disgusting, contemptful speech that we're hearing today.
Amy, let me just take that and hold it for one second, get one more call, and I'll come right to it. Greg in Bowling Green, Kentucky. You're on, Greg.
Hi, Tom. I think the founding fathers would appreciate what's been going on. I think we've gotten to a point with political correct speech that we're so worried about offending people, we no longer think everybody's concerned about how we feel. And if you differ from somebody, they label you a hate monger. I don't hate anybody. I strongly disagree with them. Lenny Bruce made, he was a comic in the 50s. Yep. He was a comedian. And he was jailed repeatedly for what was considered vulgar speech and obscenities. One thing that he said was, well, liberals can understand everything except people that don't understand them.
Greg, we've got it. I appreciate your call as well. We're looking at the tradition of freedom of speech and fiery political wrangling in this country. Steve Solomon, there's two quite different impulses back to back. Greg, who says, let it rip. Amy, who says, it's just going too far. You're getting to hate-mongering. She's disgusted.
Well, civility is a good thing. I mean, wouldn't everybody or most people want to have discussions and debates where people respected one another? I mean, you can really dig into the issues that way. But that's just not the way everybody conducts business in this country. And when a lot is at stake, people tend to get emotional. A lot of the harsh speech is conveys emotional content. It shows that people feel very strongly about it, and that's protected by the First Amendment. The question of clamping down on things that are regarded as vulgar or offensive, there's real problems with that, because who is going to define what's vulgar and what's offensive? I mean, what's offensive to me may be different than what's offensive to you. Everybody has their sensitivities, and you simply would not be able to conduct a free and open discussion if you went into that discussion feeling that you could be sued or prosecuted for saying something that somebody else finds offensive. And so the solution in this country has been, unless someone threatens somebody, unless someone incites violence, unless someone, sort of meets the legal definition of libel, speech is protected. And it's all the vulgarity and offensiveness is part of the price of living in a free society and in which anything can be discussed.
I still wonder when
go overboard.
Yeah, I still wonder when it goes right to hate. I also keep thinking about how everything you're describing here was happening at a time when many of these same politicians in their own voices were speaking so elegantly and eloquently about a political philosophy that they explored deeply and, brought to be out of whole cloth. I put that up against people today, politicians who may be on that stage and coarse and vulgar, but they don't go back and write the Declaration of Independence. They don't go back and bring us the sort of elevating discourse to sit alongside that display, Steve.
Yeah, well, I mean, these are complex people, and so they're certainly they're intellectual giants. I mean, they're writing the Constitution and writing the Federalist Papers and all, but they did have another side to them, and they felt deeply about issues, and they attacked when necessary, when they felt it was necessary, and that's you know, that's just part of, I think, the complexity that we all have, is that we have different sides to ourselves. And the fact that, at least back in the founding period, that the framers felt that if they're going to attack that way, that they should do it with pseudonyms, kind of tells us they didn't really want to be associated with it by name. And so there was that element to it as well, is not so much the case today with Donald Trump taking to his Twitter account. He doesn't seem to care. And in fact, that seems to be a strategy.
I mean, what if we get the vulgar today without the exalted, without the sort of enlightened?
Well, I guess that's the perils of a democracy and freedom. The people can choose to basically argue at whatever level they want. And that's why you see at the same time that you have learned scholars and others who argue issues in long articles or books on the one hand, and you have others who spew hatred and attack other groups and put out a lot of vitriol. It's just the society we live in. And again, I don't know what you do about that without having the government say that there's certain speech that's off limits. And then you get back to seditious libel that we threw off back in the 1800s, 1700s. And that would be a very bad thing.
Stephen Solomon, keeping the faith right there, even in a time when it can be pretty rugged in the political sphere. Steve, you write about it really wonderfully in this book. It's a great revisiting of where we've come from. It really throws a lot of light on where we are now. I'm grateful to you for being with us this hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
I really appreciate your invitation to join you.
Steve Solomon. Stephen, his book is Revolutionary Dissent, How the Founding Generation Created the Freedom of Speech. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.